From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Bookstore owners have been nervous about digital books for years now, with good reason. E-books account for more than a quarter of book sales these days, but there is some reason to believe the trend has plateaued. The number of digital books sold this year wasn't much different from the year before. It's hard to say why exactly. Maybe the novelty has worn off. But one industry insider had another hunch. People still love going into a bookstore, he said. It's not just the cozy feeling, it's the people. The people you find inside these stores know their stuff. And to prove it, we've invited three of them back into the studio, like we do every year around this time, to offer book ideas for those on your holiday shopping list. We'll get to as many as we can today, so get your pen handy. We're back after the news.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. Our online audio and podcasts are made possible by KUER and its listeners. If you like Radio West, help us make it happen. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. You can do that online at KUER.org. And thanks.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Black Friday is over. So is Cyber Monday. Some of you indulged. Some didn't. Some of you spent too much. Some of you feel guilty and full of regret or dread. I mean, who really needs a coil iced coffee brewer or a tequila advent calendar or a bacon making kit? And we've said this before, if you think back on the gifts that friends and family really remember, come on, it's usually the books. And so listeners, we're here for you today. Today in the program, it's our annual holiday book show. We've gathered our book experts together. They've made a list of titles and we will get to as many as we can today so you can settle in and I'll bet you will come away from this hour with a big feeling of relief. You can join us if you like, if you have your own ideas. Don't call, as a matter of fact. I'm just going to skip that part. But you can send emails, radiowest@kuer.org. Catherine Weller is back with us, the book buyer for Weller Bookworks. That's at Trolley Square in Salt Lake City. Kat, welcome back.
Thanks, Doug.
Betsy Burton owns the King's English Bookshop at 15th and 15th in Salt Lake. Betsy, welcome back to you.
Thank you, Doug.
And Ken Sanders, welcome back to you, the owner of Ken Sanders Rare Books.
There'll be no turkeys on this show today, Doug.
We will see about that. Okay. So I always, like, I don't want to spend a lot of time with this question, but it is something that I do want to ask. Your sense of what people are interested in these days, like what are people reading right now? How's business is kind of the underlying question. What are you seeing?
Well, I want to mention Small Business Saturday between the 2 days you mentioned.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
It was just overwhelmingly wonderful. People coming in, being supportive of us and saying we are part of the community. And then added to that is Indies First, which meant that all over the country, authors were coming to hand sell books at our stores. And it was absolutely wonderful. And I feel like things are turning around. This is all pro-community, pro-us, and kind of anti-Amazon as well. And it's making us all very happy.
Business has been very, very good this year. You've heard me mention my four-year-old grandson, Flynn. He's four now, almost five. His worldview on reading right now is it's very, very exciting. It's like a cipher and a code to him. So you take him to zoos, museums, cereal boxes, board game directions, even recipes with his Auntie M. The kid is devouring books and reading everything he can at four, almost five. So I predict a very good future for reading and book buyers and readers in the future.
He's the canary in the coal mine, your kid, your
he
grandkid.
Is.
Yeah, good.
He's a pretty good canary. It really is seeming like people are realizing that there is a great deal of excitement to reading, that it is a wonderful thing, that it's not a dying, lost art or trade. It's something that enlivens and enriches all of us. And that's been the source of a lot of conversation we've had in the store this year and over the holidays. And it's heartwarming for somebody who has, I just don't make my living with the book. I have lived and died with the book my whole life. And to see four-year-olds come in who love books, and to see 20-somethings come in who love books, and to see the 60-year-old with the e-reader come in because they're still reading, and they're still reading print and electronically, it's all really good right now.
Good. That's good news. Well, okay, let's jump in. Kat, I'm going to have you start.
Okie doke. First one I've got a grab bag of nonfiction to start with, and the first one is the David Foster Wallace Reader. In keeping with David Foster Wallace's books, this is a doorstop, just like they always are, right?
Yeah.
But it's a beautiful book, as befits probably one of our greatest writers of the late 20th century. It is a selection of writings, excerpts, and expansions by other authors. The selections were all done by the David Foster Wallace Literary Trust and his editor, Michael Peach. So it is a really nice core group of stories and essays, but also things that one wouldn't expect to see in the book as well, such as his very first published story, which isn't excerpted elsewhere, bizarro notes on grammar. And then periodically through at the end of each of some of these pieces, there are afterwards from well-known authors who talk about how they have read this particular piece of David Foster Wallace's over the years, or what it has done for them as readers. It's just a treasure for anybody who is a person who loves David Foster Wallace. Don't think because you have the canon that this isn't a book that doesn't belong on your shelf. If you really love him, it really does belong on your shelf.
Great.
So it's called The David Foster Wallace Reader.
Terrific.
Next one is The History of Rock and Roll in 10 Songs by Grail Marcus.
Yeah.
Grail, I think, is brilliant. I think he's one of the best music writers out there. He takes a very different, some would say iconoclastic, view of music and culture and how it fits in. His previous best-known book, Lipstick Traces, is still a book I turn back to for cultural reads. This is a history of rock and roll that's different from all other history of rock and rolls. It is not a chronology. He picks 10 songs and a counterpoint to those 10 songs to explore what was happening in music and what was happening in the world at that time. So you've got everything from Joy Division, a band that I grew up with back in the day, to Amy Winehouse in the present, and how they took songs that were already written and made them their own, how they made the music their own, and how we made it our own, and what it says about all of it, most particularly those 10 very songs that he explores.
Terrific.
So, History of Rock and Roll in 10 Songs by Grail Marcus. The last is from a local author. This is a great book. Jim Steinberg is on faculty at the University of Utah. He's in the meteorology department. And this book is The Secrets of the Greatest Snow on Earth, with a very long, almost 18th century subtitle, Weather, Climate Change, and Finding Deep Powder in Utah's Wasatch Mountains and Around the World. So he focuses on the weather, like he does on his Weather Weenies blog, but also on what makes this climate so particular and so interesting for snow, and what makes our weather so particular and interesting as opposed to snow in other parts of the world. We've often said, for instance, that the snow here is drier than it is elsewhere. He debunks that myth. That's not why we have great powder. You've got to read what he says about why we have great powder. But it's a terrific book for everybody who loves Wasatch weather and for everybody who loves winter sports. He knows his stuff, but he's entertaining too. So Secrets of the Greatest Snow on Earth, Jim Steinberg.
Terrific. Great. Betsy.
Okay, I'm going to start with nonfiction too this time, because I think this book is so important. It's Just Mercy by Bryan Stevenson. And it's a book that made me angrier, I think, than any book I've ever read in my entire life. It just blew me away. It starts, Bryan Stevenson was at Harvard Law, and he was very disillusioned. He didn't think that he really wanted to be a lawyer, because it was all about money and the bottom line. And he did an internship in Atlanta, was sent to interview a death row inmate in Alabama, who was his age, and they viewed the world quite similarly, and it opened his eyes. And he went back, finished law school, went back to Atlanta. His first case was somebody on death row in Alabama. And the book, during the whole book, this one case, Walter McMillan, stretches across the book. And this is a man who was at a family reunion when a murder was committed. He had 30 witnesses who knew he hadn't committed the crime. Everybody knew why he was accused. That was just perjured testimony. Didn't matter. This is the South. This is the way our justice system works, not just in the South. And that's just one focus of the book. He examines prisons. He examines, death row inmates who are children and he actually fought against the life imprisonment and won all the way up to the Supreme Court. He shows us women in prisons. He shows us the mentally ill. You get so mad reading it, you think this can't, private prisons and what they do to people, you think this just can't be how we're living. This, people are being enslaved. It's a very important book. The New York Review of Books said about this book that it really was better than To Kill a Mockingbird and more important. So it's amazing.
Yeah, I read about that. And they say the writing was
really He's a amazing. Wonderful writer.
Yeah.
It's just an amazing
book. Say it again.
Just Mercy, and it's Bryan Stevenson.
Yeah.
So, okay, then back here at home, this begins to sound dark. It's a memoir of a man here at home, Jeff Metcalf, bookended by the fact that he has cancer. But it, as it says, it's a requiem for the living. It's about life, not death. So he set out to write when he knew his diagnosis was terminal, every week an essay. This is most of, not all, but most of these essays. And they're grouped chronologically. So we see him growing up, Saudi Arabia, Holland here in Salt Lake. Then we see him as this lively adult,
funny,
madcap, avid fisherman, just crazy.
He's probably fishing right now.
He probably is. And maybe in Ireland, which is where he loves to go more than any place else in the world. And then madcap, you know, going to the Blaskets, risking his life on a trout stream, risking his marriage just to do something that he wanted to do to surprise his wife. Just so madcap, you think, is this guy nuts? But then you think, no, he's not nuts. He's living life to the full.
Yeah.
And, you know, his years are numbered. It's just absolutely a wonderful read. He's a great writer. So, Requiem for the Living by Jeff Metcalf. And then another local book that I love is The Year of Living Virtuously, Weekends Off. And this is Teresa Jordan. And when I first looked at it, I thought, living virtuously, huh? Doesn't sound like so much fun. She takes Ben Franklin's 12 virtues, and he had to add a 13 when his friend reminded him he really wasn't very good at humility, and corresponding vices, and blogs every day, all year long, except on weekends. And, you know, does some wonderful stuff in here. There's one where she talks about temperance and talks about this unbelievably delicious, wonderful food, and then how the temperance piece is, if you take more than one helping, you kind of distill the impact. So it goes all the way through.
Mention who Teresa is again. I'm sure people will know.
Oh, she wrote Riding the White Horse Home. And that History of Cowgirls, is it?
Yes.
She's an artist. She did those little drawings.
Married to Hal Cannon.
Yeah, married to Hal Cannon. They're a wonderful couple. She's a great, great writer.
She really is.
And this is a book you want to keep by your bedside forever. The Year of Living Virtuously.
She has a thing for chickens.
She does. And,
and there's a chicken on the cover.
It's her chicken.
Say it again. The Year of Living Virtuously. Weekends Off.
Teresa Jordan.
Yeah. Great. Ken Sanders.
Well, I'm going to begin on a sad note, Doug, because we lost a good friend of mine and a great writer last summer, Charles Bowden, very familiar, of course, to you and the Radio West crowd from his many appearances on your show over the years. It's very difficult for me to talk about Chuck, especially in the past tense. I think that maybe all of the crime, all of this incredible world that he exposed us to over the years, maybe it just I don't think his heart could absorb any more of other people's pain. I mean, this is a man that exposed the head of the Juarez drug cartel in one of his books. This is a man who video interviewed and helped make an actual film and a book about a sicario, a Mexican term for one of the cartel assassins. This is a man who undercover interviewed a active DEA agent that told him all kinds of secrets about drugs and the border and on both sides of the border and how, you know, we're ultimately the consumer of all these illegal drugs that flow across the border despite this ridiculous giant wall that we've built to stop seemingly people, not drugs.
And I think that's one of the reasons why a lot of us were surprised that he died of natural causes. A lot of us expected him to...
He died in his sleep. Yeah. He had a very bad flu. Basically, he died taking a nap of a heart attack while he was sleeping. We all, as you say, we always expected Chuck to get whacked.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it's just, it's a big miss. And I think it's best if, I think we have a clip we can play.
Yeah.
And I think it's best to let Chuck talk about Joey O'Shea, I believe. That was a pseudonym of the DEA agent, whose real name is revealed with his permission, of course, in the paperback version. And I had to do a double take when I first got the paperbacks in, because the real Joey O'Shea is named Kim Sanders is his real name.
Wow.
A little too close for comfort.
No,
well, Chuck joined us in 2005, and here he is reading from his book. It's called Shadow in the City.
For more than 20 years, he has lived underground, a predator feeding off the flesh of the city. He began working in a neighborhood. Then he entered the commerce of flesh and finally found his place in the drug world. He discovered he was better than good at his work. Soon he was pulled into a group that melded local people with national talent. He's a person of no particular standing. He wears street clothes. In a hive of agents and bureaucrats, he operates independently. This is permitted because he makes deals and others can ride on the success of these deals. This suits him because he does not like being told what to do. He's killed, been in shootings, gone into rooms too many times where guns began firing, but he's never been shot. And he can't speak of these matters. There's an etiquette in his world that holds such talk obscene, a kind of bragging left to liars and to those with no morals. He can barely use the word kill, not because of a need for euphemisms, but because of the demands of silence. To take a life is bad. To speak of it is unforgivable.
Chuck Bowden, when he joined us in 2005, talking about his book Shadow in the City. Ken, maybe you could say something, since we're trying to give people suggestions for book ideas. I'll suggest Blood Orchid. That's one of
Absolutely.
My favorite things that he's written. You want to say another?
Yeah, Blood Orchid is the first of his blood trilogy, if you will, with the Blues for Cannibals and some of the dead are still breathing. Earlier books, his very first book, Killing the Hidden Waters, is an extremely erudite account of water usage in the arid Southwest. Blue Desert is a very accessible book. I love the Mezcal Red Line. Dreamland, a collaboration with the artist Alice Liorta Briggs, is... using the word graphic novel fails to convey the intensity and the complexity of the marriage of the words and the art in that book. And he was working, finished a draft of a new book, a new collaboration with Alice Liorta Briggs when he died, called Rhapsody. I don't have any information on a publication date for that, but that'll be the last legacy of his 21 books.
But you'll help us put together a list of books from Chuck that people can...
Yes, they're, yeah. It's already done.
It's on the list? Brilliant. Yep. Okay. Should have known that. List of all of these books mentioned on the program today, available on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. Ken, thanks very much. Ken Sanders. Ken Sanders' rare books. Betsy Burton, of course, with us at the King's English Bookshop on 15th and 15th. And Catherine Weller with us from Willer Bookworks in Trolley Square. We'll take a break and be back with more titles. In just a moment, you're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, it's our annual holiday book show, which means we've gathered our experts, our typical experts from local bookstores offering ideas for your shopping list. We have with us Betsy Burton of the King's English Bookshop, Catherine Weller of Weller Bookworks, and Ken Sanders of Ken Sanders Rare Books. Okay, back to it. Betsy, okay. You get us started.
Okay, I'm going to talk about three novels, but before I do, I just have to mention All the Light We Cannot See by Anthony Doerr, because it's the best novel of the year, in my opinion. I just loved it. I've talked about it till I'm blue in the face on this program before, so I won't go on.
And he talked about it till he was blue in the face on the program, too.
I know.
He was great, yeah.
And he is great.
Yeah.
Okay, so For the Fall, the first novel that I want to talk about is The Children Act by Ian McEwan, who is always a wonderful novelist. This book starts with a woman. She's a high court judge, and she's home going over a case, and her husband walks in, pours a drink, and tells her that he would like to have an affair. Not that he wants to break up the marriage, just that he wants to have an affair. He wants the marriage to maintain. He wants one last shot at passion. Well, this leaves her speechless. Right after that, she gets a case involving a young man whose illness doesn't need to be terminal, but will be if he doesn't get treatment. And his parents are, I can't remember, Christian Scientists perhaps, but don't believe in medical intervention. And she's asked to go visit him. So there are these two things that are totally upending her life and the way she thinks about herself. And so the book is about both of them. And we talked a little bit about somebody who didn't like an ending for All the Light, which I loved. I feel that way about this book, too. I think the ending is perfect in terms of the characters. It's a very interesting book and, of course, beautifully written by Ian McEwan, The Children Act. So that's number one. Number two, Calm Tobin. I thought it was Tobin, but it's Tobin, apparently. Nora Webster. He is a wonderful Irish writer. He wrote The Master in Brooklyn. Nora Webster is a very unusual novel in the sense that it's so quiet. It starts out with a woman grieving. You don't exactly like her because she's not treating her kids very well. She's so subsumed by her grief. And you're thinking, am I going to like this book? And then as she begins to wake up, we see more and more of her both in the present and in the past. So it's like this double unspooling. And it's just beautifully done. And she becomes more and more interesting, but always in this quiet way. And you utterly believe in her. And most men who write about women, I think, they don't usually convince me.
I agree.
Yeah. And I'm even talking, you know, Anna Karenina. Leaving her kid? Are you kidding me? I don't buy that. But anyway, you buy everything she does in this book. It's brilliantly done in a quiet way, and I loved it. Nora Webster, Calm Tobin.
Yeah.
And then on a very different note, a very, very funny novel called Dear Committee Members by Julie Shoemaker.
Yeah.
Oh, this is so funny. So she really is a professor, and she really does write these letters of recommendation and interdepartmental memos. That's what this whole book is. It's a epistolary novel. And it is these letters of recommendation by this English professor who's washed up, and frankly, English is washed up at his university, and the humanities are washed up. Nobody cares about any of it. He's in a basement, and he's writing these letters of recommendation, which, believe me, nobody who received one would hire the person that it's about, except this one guy, Darren Bowles, who's writing a history of a takeoff on Bartleby the Scrivener set in a bordello in Las Vegas. That's the one he thinks is brilliant. And it's just it's hysterically funny, but it's also got a kind of a dark and touching vein, too. Dear Committee Members by Julie Shoemaker.
That's great. Catherine.
Okay, this really is a sadder show than a lot of years.
Yeah.
We're commemorating writers that have passed this year that mean a lot to us, and I think every writer on our list has meant a lot to each of us in this room. Peter Matheson died in April. It was a sad passing for me because I'd gotten used to kind of seeing him come to town over the years. I think we've all had him in our stores over the years. In the past few years, he's been here with the College of Humanities here at the University of Utah, and it's always been wonderful to see how he's grown and changed in his practice of writing and in his practice of Zen as well. Mm-hmm. His very first book, The Snow Leopard, was a book that changed a lot of things for a lot of people, including me. We've got a clip here where he's describing the feelings of home that he finds while he's not at home, but he is in the Himalayas.
I grow into these mountains like a moss. I am bewitched.
the blinding snow peaks in the clarion air, the sound of earth and heaven in the silence, the requiem birds, the mythic beasts, the flags, great horns, and old carved stones, the rough-hewn Tartars in their braids and homespun boots, the silver ice in the Black River, the Kang, the Crystal Mountain. Also, I love the common miracles, the murmur of my friends at evening, the clay fires of smudgy juniper, the coarse, dull food, the hardship and simplicity, the contentment of doing one thing at a time. When I take my blue tin cup into my hand, that is all I do. We have had no news of modern times since late September, and will have none until December, and gradually my mind has cleared itself, and wind and sun pour through my head as through a bell. We talk little here, yet I am never lonely. I am returned into myself. Having got here at last, I do not wish to leave the Crystal Mountain. I am in pain about it, truly, so much so that I have to smile or I might weep. In another life, this isn't what I know, but how I feel. These mountains are my home. There is a rising of forgotten knowledge, like a spring from hidden aquifers under the earth. To glimpse one's own true nature is a kind of home-going, to a place east of the sun, west of the moon, the home-going that needs no home, like that waterfall on the upper Sully River that turns to mist before touching the earth and rises once again into the sky.
Peter Matheson. So Snow Leopard, do you want to say another few that you recommend?
Yeah, and I do have to mention that Peter Matheson is the only person who's won the National Book Award for both fiction and nonfiction. The Snow Leopard was the winner twice, interestingly enough, for fiction. For nonfiction. And it really paved the path for a new kind of writing, or helped continue a kind of writing, where he explored, in the tradition of Sir Richard Burton,
yeah,
the travel narrative, but combined it with the naturalist writing and the meditative writing.
Yeah, I've heard him described as a travel writer. I'm like, he's more than a travel writer.
He's so much more than that. He expands on it brilliantly with that sense of pilgrimage and exploration, his own spiritual pilgrimage, the pilgrimage through the land, and then his keen naturalist eye. I usually bring in ARCs or new copies of books. This is my first copy of The Snow Leopard, my poor beat up first copy of The Snow Leopard. Other books of his, Shadow Country, yeah, is the book for which he won the National Book Award. Yeah, he put three of his novels together. It's set in the South. It's a brilliant expose of the lack of justice in the South, race relations, what it is to be poor, what it is to try to find justice when that's really not an option for you. His last book, In Paradise, was published a few days after he died. That was one of the heartbreaking things for me. He didn't get to see the final cap on his career. That book, in a way, is a good cap for his career. It is it's a fictionalized account of an exploration he took in, I believe he actually went to Auschwitz, I'm not remembering correctly, perhaps with Bernie Glassman and a group of people who wanted to meditate and try to reclaim and experience that space in a different way.
Right. Okay.
Tree Where Man Was Born is one of my Matheson favorites.
It's beautiful, brilliant, if you can find it.
So, is it hard to find?
It can't, it's, yeah, it
not,
can be.
Yeah,
you got to be looking
shop,
in the right place.
Okay, Ken Sanders.
I want to take some time to go local here, Doug, because there's a lot of interesting new books coming out. First is the latest of Signature Books, who I think are one of the finest Utah Mormon history publishers we have today. December 15th, it's not quite out, and I forgot to bring the ARC with me, but The Council of 50, a documentary history by Jedediah S. Rogers, editor. It's coming out in about a week, week and a half, and it's, again, in this series of just wonderful, detailed histories of the early Mormon church, which is really echoing and paralleling what the LDS church church itself is doing as it's entered online reality and the blogosphere, if you will, with all the dust up that went as far as the New York Times over the polygamy books and the recent revelation I just learned this morning that the signature book ads for polygamy yes. books were run by the Salt Lake Tribune, but not the Deseret News, which puzzled their marketing director tremendously.
Did that surprise you?
No, because I've been there, done that. But that's certainly one of the great new titles. There's also a this year published biography of Joseph Smith, as if we needed another one. But this is a really interesting one by a complete outsider to the faith. So I really like it from that fresh perspective. The author is Alex Beam, and the book is called American Crucifixion, The Murder of Joseph Smith and the Fate of the Mormon Church.
We had him on the show, by the way.
Yeah, that really interesting.
Really.
And then just quickly, I want to just mention a bunch of local stuff that's come out. There's a great new Zion Canyon Reader, edited by Nathan Waite and Reed Nielsen, which is a wonderful little book. Desert Water, The Future of Utah's Water Resources, edited by Hal Krimmel. There's a great new intellectual and creative literary magazine called Salt Front, Studies in Human Habit that has come out. Local filmmaker Trent Harris has issued his latest masterpiece, Luna Mesa, in a limited edition DVD with special features package.
That's got to be a trip.
It's actually... It's a really good movie. I love this one. It stars Richard Dutcher is in it.
Dutcher, a filmmaker
in his own right.
Yep.
Sarah Caldiero, daughter of the one-of-a-kind sinosopher Alex Caldiero. I didn't bring it because it's a giant work of art in this handmade cedar box. It's a scroll book that she did a performance of it at Rose Wagner recently. The book is called The Headless Housewife, a book of anarchy and imaginary solutions by Sarah Caldiero Orti. Wonderful stuff. Lance Olson, poet here up the U, How to Unfeel the Dead. Jeff Metcalf, that Betsy's always talked about, his new book, which really echoes the late poet laureate Ken Brewer's Whale Song, A Journey into Cancer. Books with heavy subjects, but really they're for the living. That both of these people teach us not how to die, but how to live while dying. Right. And at their best. And lastly, because I always like to do non-book stuff, Hal Cannon, a Utah treasure for decades and decades, has got a brand new band he's formed down in Virgin, Utah, with some really suspicious-looking characters. And all notice they're wearing hats, and they call themselves the Three Hat Trio. Previously mentioned, Teresa Jordan's husband. Really fun new music. These guys are having a ball, no matter how seedy they might look on the back of the CD. No pun intended there. It's wonderful music. We had them at the bookstore. It was a great, great evening of music and storytelling.
Great. Okay. Betsy Burton.
Yes. Well, sadness again.
Yeah.
You know, Mark Strand, who taught here for 8 years, and Kent Hariff, also beloved by all of us, died within 24 hours of one another just a few days ago. So a week ago for Mark. So. Not quite that, actually.
What do you recommend for Kent? Plain Song or Eventide?
I think Benediction, because for those who love him, that book is the perfect way to say goodbye. It's about a man dying, but like the books we just talked about, it's about how to live a worthwhile life, not how to die. And both men, I think, face their deaths with enormous courage and acceptance. I don't think either of them were afraid to die. Mark Strand was an incredibly gifted poet, one of the major poets of our time. He won a MacArthur, the Pulitzer. This was the collected poems was listed for the National Book Award. He was our National Poet Laureate. He was internationally known as well. He just, you know, in Italy, he's a god, or was. So, well-known poet, he had an 80th birthday party not long ago at the New School, both for his birthday and for the publication of the collected poems. He had said a few years back, I'm not ready to publish my collected poems because, of course, collected poems are the work of your lifetime.
Yeah.
He was now ready. And so 20 poets got up and read from the work, and it was astonishing. Jackie Oshiro was there. Her reading, of course, she's a wonderful reader. Nobody read better than Mark. His reading of his own work is incredible. Mark started out with a very dark sensibility, writing clever and mysterious and very dark poems. And when he was here, he achieved a kind of peace of some sort, I think. I don't know. But his poems were more plain spoken, more accessible, and always with the ambiguity and the mystery. But that and the collections, all in this collection, but A Continuous Life and Blizzard of One, I think, are the very apex of his work. And then when he left, he became dark again, but funny dark. His poems were very, very witty. And his last collection, he claimed at the end, was prose. In fact, I think he fought with Knopf about it. So to me, his poetry spanned the way one learns to think and grow up. We start very dark. We tend to, you know, like movies like The Pawnbroker. And then life does open up. And then, if we're lucky, humor lands. And I think Mark was lucky. He said at the end, "I'm not afraid, and I am very thankful for the life I've lived." He said, "I've had a chance to do what I wanted, and who can ask for more than that?" So this poem that we're going to hear is called The End, and it's from that middle period where mystery was still there, but he was embracing both life and death, and I think it sums up his end brilliantly.
Not everyone knows what he shall sing at the end, watching the pier as the ship sails away, or what it will seem like when he's held by the sea's roar motionless there at the end, or what he shall hope for once it is clear that he'll never go back. When the time is past to prune the rose or caress the cat, when the sunset torching the lawn and the full moon icing it down no longer appear, not everyone knows what he'll discover instead. When the weight of the past leans against nothing, and the sky is no more than remembered light, and the stories of cirrus and cumulus come to a close, and all the birds are suspended in flight, not everyone knows what is waiting for him, or what he shall sing when the ship he is on slips into darkness there at the end.
Mark Strand died November 29th. Betsy, thanks.
Thank you.
Ken Sanders, back to you.
Mysteries and bibliomysteries, Doug. I accidentally recently discovered a book published a couple of years ago, and coincidentally, the author just had his second bibliomystery come out. The author in question is Charlie Lovett, and his first book is The Bookman's Tale, a novel of obsession. When I first read the liner notes, oh, another mystery involving Shakespeare? I don't know. But boy, once I started reading it, oh man, was I hooked. This has got like Shakespeare as part of like a drinking club back in the day. And, you know, some of the other guys are kind of jealous of the guy and others, and make fun of him. And it's just, it really brings the period to life. And it's actually three different tales of a modern day couple who's a Shakespearean scholar on a quest that leads back to the Victorian era and a whole separate novel there. And then an earlier novel contemporary with Shakespeare and Marlowe and all of the contemporaries of that time. He has a brand new one that just came out. And I had
you'll the, find it.
Yeah, not very organized apparently. It'll come to me.
Yeah, it will.
But also, some old masters have some great new mysteries out. Michael Connelly, the Gods of Guilt, James Lee Burke, Wayfaring Stranger, Swedish writer Joe Nesbo. His latest one is really, really powerful, The Sun. And almost local, Wyomingite Craig Johnson and his Longmire series that apparently has just been recently canceled by HBO.
But then reissued, I think.
Yeah, and someone else picked them up.
Yeah.
He's very happy about that. And his new Longmire novel any other name, and I think he just keeps getting better with each book. And the First Impressions is the name of the brand new Charlie Lovett Biblio Mystery, and I haven't had a chance to read it yet, but I'm really looking forward to it.
Great. Kat.
Okay, fiction from me now. First is a novel that came out from Torrey House Press, another one of our great local publishers right now, by a very talented young writer named Braden Heppner. The book is called Pale Harvest, and oh, it's dark. It is bleak and sad, but it is beautiful. This is the story of a young man who is working on his grandfather's farm. His parents are dead, and he's working with his grandfather while his grandmother is bedbound and dying. They're trying to keep their family-owned dairy farm set somewhere in Utah alive in the face of never-ending work, exhaustion, shrinking profits, and a small town that is dying the thousands of deaths that small towns in the West die every day these days. It is lovely. There's a woman who comes into the picture from Salt Lake with her worldly ways that sweeps this young farmer off his feet, and all he wants to do is marry her and settle down and run this farm the way a dairy farm should be run, the way he knows it can be run. And all he gets in this book is not that. But it is... I keep trying to think of a better way to describe it that makes it not sound so sad. But it's one of those books that is brilliant because it is sad, because it treats a very difficult and subject, the real lives of real people in the West, fictionally, but truthfully. So you see great beauty in here, hard labor and love and failures all around. It's called Pale Harvest by Braden Heppner. Next is a historical novel from Algonquin called High Divide by Len Enger. This is set in the West, in the territories, in the late 1800s. And one morning, a man named Ulysses, and I can't believe that his name is an accident, gets up and says goodbye to his son, and he leaves, and he doesn't come back, and he doesn't come back, and he doesn't come back. Then his sons intercept a mysterious letter from a mysterious woman, and they decide they need to go find him. So they leave. They're hopping trains because they're kids and walking, and they head out into South Dakota looking for him. Greta Pope, his wife, now everybody's gone, the rent is due, they're all really wrapped up in difficulties, and she sets out looking for her children, because these are children. Everybody in the Pope family is wandering around through South Dakota, through Wisconsin, through the Montana territories. They're seeking redemption, ultimately, and they do find it. There's sacrifice to Abrahamic proportions in this book. And in a really neat historical note, Ulysses meets up with the Hornaday Expedition, which is a great expedition sent out by the Smithsonian Institution to find and shoot one of the last remaining herd of bison, because they were one of the last remaining herd of bison, which meant they needed to be stuffed and sent back to Washington so people would know what
them.
This animal is, because they'll never know again. And so this is a story of the death of the West, the death of hope, and ultimately the redemption of all of those things. High Divide by Len Enger. The last is completely different. It's The Book of Strange New Things by Michael Faber, who had previous acclaim for his sci-fi novel Under the Skin and his historical novel The Crimson Petal and the White. This book is an interesting combination of literary fiction and science fiction. In it, a British man, is chosen to go minister to the first colony on a foreign planet, on a different planet far, far away. And he finds out that he's not sent there to minister to the people who are colonizing the planet, but to its natives, who previously learned from a different minister about the Bible, which they call the Book of Strange New Things. The book intersperses the stories of his wife, who he had to leave behind in London, and it's going to hell in a very quiet, slow decline. And meanwhile, back at the ranch on this planet that is unnamed, things are also strange and not quite what they seem, neither the people nor the aliens. And as he tries to preach the word of God and live the word of God as he believes a true Christian would, he needs to make some decisions about what that ultimately means in, for his role as a husband and his role as a pastor to these aliens. It's called The Book of Strange New Things by Michael Faber. And if you geek out about pretty books, this is a pretty book. Gilt edges, nice
yeah,
cover.
Great. Catherine Weller from Weller Bookworks at Trolley Square. We have Betsy Burton with us as well from the King's English at 15th and 15th. And Ken Sanders from Ken Sanders Rare Books on 2nd East in Salt Lake City. A list of all of these books, even the ones we don't get to, because we won't get to all of them. We never do. Will be available on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We're going to talk kids' books and try to get to a lightning round, if we can, when we get back from a break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us our three experts in books, giving us book title suggestions for holiday gift ideas, and we're going to jump right back into it. Let's see. So we're doing children's books now, and we're going to start with Ken Sanders, right?
You bet.
All right, go.
Okay, we all have somebody on our holiday gift list that's impossible to buy for or has everything or is particularly difficult to buy for. Boy, have I got the answer for you. It's a children's classic, Alice in Wonderland, and it's rendered completely in the Deseret alphabet.
Get out of town.
I guarantee you, nobody's got this book, baby.
That's unbelievable. Wow.
And as a bonus, you get to learn Deseret in order to read it.
What the
it's
hell?
Got the mouse's tail. It's got the whole works. And nobody's got this one, baby. I want to give a shout out, a retro shout out, because I always like to do this. Adolescent boys, as we all know, or pre-adolescent boys, can be very, very difficult to buy for. This whole series based loosely on an old Alfred Hitchcock thing called The Three Investigators. There's dozens and dozens of titles in the series, and they're absolutely, even though they're old, they're absolutely wonderful, and they really speak to a young male audience. They're really great. These are better than Hardy Boys.
Say it again, the title.
For boys, and The Three Investigators. This particular one is The Mystery of the Missing Mermaid. But there are several dozen of these, and they're great. And lastly, you know, I've mentioned the Kala editions that are great, hardbound, beautiful, beautifully produced, high-quality books. If you ever wanted to start an heirloom tradition of book giving, the two new ones in the series are Hansel and Gretel. That's not a Kala book, but Neil Gaiman's Hansel and Gretel. Gretel is a beautiful illustrated book. The Gulliver's Travels with Arthur Rackham is a terrific classic, as is the Edmund Detmold illustrated Fables of Aesop. Really great, beautiful new classics.
Great. Catherine.
Okay, my first book is called The Stick by Clay Rice. This is a picture book by a man who illustrates his picture books with silhouettes. So it's a slightly different look. It's very deep and luscious and gorgeous. It's the story of a young boy who finds a stick with mysterious carvings on it. And through his lifelong possession of that stick, he discovers imagination, he discovers his dreams, and his potential in life. It's a beautiful story about imagination, fulfillment, and discovery. Next is Mom and Dad Are Palindromes by Mark Shulman and Adam McCauley. This is a fun book on language. It's about a kid who one morning wakes up and realizes that his mom and dad are palindromes. Oh, my Lord, and his pup Otto is a palindrome, and his sister's name is a palindrome. He's just trapped by them. It's a fantastic, almost comic book layout, great funny story, and a great way to explore language, such as Kook and Did I Did. Last and quickly is Scott Westerfeld's book, Afterworld. It's a wonderful book within a book. It's the story of a young woman named Darcy who writes an award-winning Hindu paranormal romance. goes to New York and finds that that romance comes to life. So there's the story of Darcy in New York with all kinds of neat YA authors learning about the book industry.
Huh.
And then there's this weird Hindu paranormal romance. It's great. Afterworlds by Scott Westerfeld.
Great. Betsy.
Okay. First of all, I'm going to do a holiday book, and instead of doing a Christmas book, of which there are, of course, many, I'm going to do a Hanukkah book called I Know an Old Lady Who Swallowed a Dreidel. And it goes along with I Know an Old Lady Who Swallowed a Fly, I Know an Old Lady Who Swallowed a Dreidel, a Hanukkah dreidel she thought was a betel. Perhaps it was fatal. In the end, of course, she burps, and it wasn't fatal at all. Then transitional reader, Shannon Hill and Dean Hill have written a wonderful book called Princess Black. In the first place, the princess is pink and perfect, and not that skinny little princess that everybody expects. And secretly, she is the princess in black. And she has an ogre ring, alarm ring, and she goes off to rescue two goats from an ogre. Princess, she's the Zora of our time. Then finally, Death Coming Up the Hill by Chris Crow. This is dark. It is the year 1968, told in haiku. Each haiku is 17 syllables. Over the course of that year, the number of syllables equal the number of soldiers who were killed. And it's beautifully written. There's a marriage, and you know, the boy's parents' marriage involved. And it is kind of one of a kind. I've never seen a book like this. It's called Death Coming Up the Hill, Chris Crow, who teaches actually at BYU.
Wow. Okay, we've got like a minute for a lightning round. You want to say something quick, Kat?
Haruki Murakami, novella, just came out. Strange Library, great package.
Betsy.
How to Be Both, Ali Smith, just out. I'm in the middle of it. It's fabulous and very funny.
The Complete Zap Comics, Underground Comics with Robert Crumb, Rick Griffin, Moscoso, and all the rest in a giant, lavish box set.
Let's do one more, Kat.
Fermented Vegetables. You know you want to learn how to make kimchi yourself.
Yes, you do. Betsy.
Let Me Be Frank With You, Richard Ford. It's Frank Bascom. We thought it was done, but it isn't, and it's great.
Last Stories and Other Stories by William T. Volman. Nice, big, new, hardbound reader of Volman.
Great. That's Ken Sanders of Ken Sanders Rare Books, Betsy Burton with the King's English at 15th and 15th, Catherine Weller from Weller Bookworks at Trolley Square. Thank you all very much for being with us. List of all these books mentioned, even the ones we didn't get to, all of them, are on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. You can follow Radio West on Tumblr, where we host the Radio West Library. It's a quick list of the authors that we interview for the show. Also, go to Video West today. We're featuring a number of new shorts that we hope you check out at videowest.kuer.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.